The home and the church are alike in this respect. If they don't do the job assigned to them, that job cannot be done by anyone else with the same effect. In educating young Christians, we sure want to start before they are Christians if we can. On this topic, I was asked to talk about the parent's relationship to the child, first of all. And I think immediately of 2 Timothy 1:5, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. First in the grandmother, then in the mother, then in the son. The first step in educating young Christians, even before they become Christians, is when the child's first steps are taken. I had a mother who stayed home and raised me, and it has made a tremendous difference in my life. She read me Bible stories years before I was able to read them myself. She spent her time with me. I can still remember the sound of her voice during those years. I had a father who raised me in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, who taught me that wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. It made a big difference to me. When I visited my grandparents on either side, we talked about the Bible. When I visited my aunt and uncle, we talked about the Bible some more. It begins with the faith that's found in the parents and in the other relatives and friends who are around that child. I don't know for sure if we can make a Romans 1:16 application here or not, but I think we can at least secondarily. Therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. From faith in one to faith in another. From faith in the parents to faith in the child. This is almost faith by osmosis. And there is no faith so strong as that which begins at the mother's knee. This is where the education of young Christians begins, if we're talking about the ideal. And if the process begins any later than that, it will be a detriment to that person. Not that it can't be made up for later, but lost time will have to be made up for. So today I'd like to talk with you about the children from the time they come into the world until maybe they're about ready to leave the home. We're aware that Jesus placed a very high priority on them. He even said that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my heavenly Father. He talked about causing little ones to stumble, and while he may not have been speaking just of children, certainly children could have been included in that. I'd like to spend some time in the book of Proverbs today, and maybe the most familiar verse in the whole book is Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. The expression train up has to do with the mouth, in particular the palate or the gums, the inside of the mouth. It's used sometimes to refer to the breaking of a wild horse, bringing into submission by a rope in the mouth. The word is also used to refer to the action of a midwife soon after the birth of a child, when she would dip her finger into dates that had been chewed up or ground up, crushed, so that the juice would bring a tangy sensation into the mouth of the child and cause that child to be interested in sucking or nursing. Then place the baby in the mother's arms for that purpose. The word child in Proverbs 22:6 is a very elastic term in the Old Testament, sometimes used of a newborn child in 1 Samuel 4. In 1 Samuel 1, it's used of a child older than that, but not yet weaned. In Genesis 21, it's used of Ishmael in his early teens. In Genesis 37, it's used of Joseph at the age of 17. In Genesis 34, it's used of a boy at marriageable age. So we're talking here from about birth to or through marriageable age when we read the word child. In the way that he should go, the word way has to do with what is in keeping with, what is in accordance to, or what is in cooperation with something. This is the same word for way that's used in the 30th chapter of the book of Proverbs when we find it four times. the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. The Hebrew term carries the idea that this is not always a pathway or a road, but it has to do with manner or characteristics. Train up a child according to his characteristics, not according to the general way in which we should all go, but according to the peculiar characteristics built into him by God that will help him to be what he or she can and should be. In the 11th chapter of the book of Psalms, the second verse, we find this: Lo, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. The wicked bend their bow. The verb form that's there used for bend is the same idea that we have in Proverbs 22 and 6. Train up a child according to his bent, according to his own peculiar, particular bent. Because in every child there is a bent already established even before that child is born. I've often heard mothers still carrying children talk about this. Well, this one seems calm. This one just about kicks me to death. They can tell the difference in the children before they're even born. So a child, when it comes to us, is not precisely like a pliable piece of clay. He has already been set, already been bent in a definite way. And the parent who wants to train that child correctly discovers that bent, learns that bent by studying the child. One child is creative, another is practical. One child is submissive, another is aggressive from the womb. One child is intelligent, another seems stupid and dull. One is always curious and absorbed, another is usually vacuous and bored. One is innovative, another is imitative. One is a joiner, another is by nature a loner. One is pugnacious, the other is timid. Know the way the child is made. Without knowing that, we can't keep Proverbs 22 and 6. We have numerous biblical examples of siblings that were a lot different from one another. Cain and Abel, who may have been twins, I don't say that they were, but we only have record there of one conception in the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis. So it's possible that they could have been twins, but whether they were or not, they were brothers and they were as different as night and day. Jacob and Esau, we know, were twins, but they were as different as night and day. One was a sort of a conniving little sissy and the other was an outdoorsman, a hunter, a he-man type, bent in different directions. Absalom and Solomon had the same father, lived the same basic court life, and yet one became a rebel and the other was a man of peace. A father should not necessarily use the same approach with all of his children. That's what I believe Proverbs 22 and 6 is telling us. Train up a child according to his way in helping him conform to the Lord's way. I believe this indicates that we should not compare our children with one another and use them as examples to one another. Judy, how come you're not like Debbie? She's so easy to raise and you're so difficult. She's not like Debbie because she's not Debbie, she's Judy. Now, I'm sure not saying that children should be allowed to run their own way. I believe just the opposite of that. But I do think it's unwise to compare the two of them to their face and try to get them to fit into the same cast. Now, Proverbs 22 and 6 said, "When he is old, he will not depart from it." The word old is a word for hair on the chin. A bearded one, when he reaches maturity. In the 139th Psalm, we have expression there from David, where he's talking about being fearfully and wonderfully made. Beginning in verse 13, "Thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them." God has done a lot of work on us by the time we're born. We've already been in existence for 9 months, And we already have a set pattern. Just how much is set, I don't know. But there is quite a bit set. And when God gives me a child, He gives me a gift. A gift that does not belong to me, but is in my care for a few years. In my keeping to develop. Each one is a distinct model, designed and fashioned by God, just as David was in the womb. There are certain inborn, God-given talents and abilities, the makeup of a certain set of attributes that compose that child. So the parents, by study and by observation, by experience with that child, discover the child. And that process does not stop. The parent is a student of the child's bents as long as the child is under the parent's care. Some people are a lot more rebellious than others. And the chances are that if you are or were rebellious, your rebellion as a child may have begun when your parents did not understand you. This is not an excuse for rebellion, but it sometimes helps to explain it. And it's an explanation that sometimes helps us to learn how to deal with it when we see it in other people or in ourselves. Your rebellion as a child may have begun when you sensed that your parents didn't understand you, and when you sensed that rightly or wrongly. And when you said that I'm willing to be developed, but they don't understand how I'm made. They don't understand what's inside of me. And the parent uses brute force and that alone. And the child turns within, becomes introspective, and develops a hatred for many things. And the parent says, well, I'm training him like the Bible says, but you're not. Because in addition to the rod, and definitely the rod is a part of the package, but in addition to the rod, we have to know the child, understand the child. No amount of training in the scriptural sense otherwise will be successful if we fail in the in-depth preparation of knowing our children. Remember the 29th chapter of the book of Proverbs. We're told there in verse 15 that the rod and reproof give wisdom. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but the child left and to himself is italicized, being supplied by the translators. I kind of wish they'd left it out. The child left bringeth his mother to shame. How many children are left today? And the child left bringeth his mother to shame. But the rod and reproof give wisdom. The right use of the rod and the right non-use of the rod. The right use of reproof without the rod. These bents of our children need to be channeled into productive areas and channeled away from the problem areas. Some children, almost from the time they're born, you see the problem areas that they may be headed into. And when you recognize that bent, then you can ward off a lot of things ahead of time, or at least have the chance. Once we put our children in the position where almost their only possible reaction to us is rebellion, we may be setting their course for a lifetime. Isn't it true that many people spend the majority of their adulthood reacting against extremes that they experienced in childhood? They'll experience extremes in one way from their parents for a few years, and they'll spend the rest of their lives reacting against that. Unfortunate, unnecessary, sad, and the fault of that child. But as parents, we might be able to keep that from happening if we know our child and raise them according to their own bents. Train up a child according to his bent. The good enhance and develop, and the bad counteract. Abraham was a liar. He said his wife was his sister. And Isaac comes along and lies in just almost precisely the same words in the same situation. And Jacob comes along just like his dad with the help of his mother and becomes a liar as well. And then we have the next generation and Judah becomes a liar. It just goes on and on, passed down. The child will not depart from the training he received, because he will be in a large measure the product of that training. Somebody said the home is the place where the life makes up its mind. And there's a lot of truth in that. God gives us little baby boys and girls. and expects us to help them develop into what he wants them to be. God give us men, wrote Josiah Holland. A time like this demands strong minds, great hearts, true faith, and ready hands. Men whom the lust of office does not kill. Men whom the pride of office cannot buy. Men who possess convictions and a will. Men who have honor. Men who will not lie. Men who can stand before a demagogue and damn his treacherous flatteries without winking. Tall men, sun-crowned men, who live above the fog in public duty and in private thinking. For while the rabble with their fun-worn creeds, their large professions and their little deeds mingle in selfish strife, lo, freedom weeps. Wrong rules the land, and waiting justice sleeps. God, give us these men. Haven't we all prayed that God would give us strong Christian people? But he gives us these babies, and he tells us to train them up in the way that they should go. As we talk about educating young Christians, building character into them, if we can possibly start very young, and we certainly can do that with our own children, we're giving them a definite advantage. I have five things that are in a general category of what we should pass on to them that I'd like to mention to you next. We need to teach our children what it feels like and what it is like to stand alone when necessary. In the first chapter of the book of Proverbs, we have a statement there beginning in verse 10. My son, when sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause, let us swallow them up alive as the grave and whole as those that go down into the pit. We shall all find precious substance, we shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast thy lot among us, let us all have one purse. My son, walk not thou in the way with them, refrain thy foot from their path, for their feet run to evil and make haste to shed blood. Consent thou not, refrain thy foot from their path, walk not in the way with them. The Bible teaches us, Old Testament and New, that we will become like those that we spend time with. Our responsibility then with our children and the other young people, little people in the church, and the children of the people in the church, is to set a standard that is right. Teach them that it's best if our best friends are Christian friends. So often our children don't know how to choose friends. They're attracted to those who are attracted to them, and they may pick the wrong ones. We need to teach them what qualities to look for in a person when we're going to call them a friend. Teach them what a friend is, what a friend does, how a friend behaves. Constantly remind them of the consequences of wrong. Because it's easy for them, just as it's easy for us, to believe the masquerade of the devil. He always presents such a beautiful picture. It wouldn't be temptation if it wasn't presented that way. As he shows us the beginning of sin, the pleasures of sin for a season, the passing pleasures of sin. Convince yourself and then convince your child that the consequences of sin are worse than the pleasures. That the consequences are not worth the pleasures. If we can convince ourselves of that, we're well on our way to dealing with temptation. Back in the Psalms, in Psalm 73, verses 2 and 3, the statement is made there that I was envious. I was envious of the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. How many of us are envious of the prosperity of the wicked? How many of us think of ourselves as being handicapped in business because we have to be honest? Those around us don't. Being handicapped when we go to court because we can't lie. Everybody else there can. How many of our children think of themselves as being handicapped in life because we're so restricted? Everybody else has free rein. The writer of the psalm said, yes, I was envious when I saw the foolish. I saw their prosperity. This is a real magnet, especially to the young, but not only to them, the young eyes and the young mind. He sees the popularity of those who are wrong and thinks, man, that'd be great. That really looks like the way to live. But in verse 17 of that same 72nd Psalm, or 73rd Psalm, he says that later in perspective, I understood their end. Everything looked great on the surface until I looked at it from God's perspective on down the line. And then I saw the end of it, that the pleasures of sin are just for a season. When I saw the end, I realized that it wasn't as good as it had looked. Acquaint yourself and acquaint your children with the biographies of the great people in the Bible, men and women, Daniel, Moses, Elijah, Ruth, Esther. Be sure they're acquainted with these. Even with the biographies of non-biblical people, people in the world whose lives present lessons for us. There's a tremendous new biography written within the last couple of years of Harry Truman. To read that book, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is immaterial. To read that book is to get a little lesson on life. Much better, I think, for the most part, than the reading of fiction. Those who walk with the wise will be wise. Proverbs 13, verse 20. You'll tend to become like those that you think about and that you spend your time with. But sometimes you have to stand alone without a companion, like Elijah did. Teach your child how to stand alone wisely, with the least embarrassment, and giving the least amount of offense. This is a mark of maturity, and a very important part of educating young people who are or will be Christians. A second thing, in addition to standing alone, be open to reproof and counsel yourself, and be sure that your child learns to be open to reproof and counsel. In the third chapter of Proverbs, we have the statement that's quoted in the book of Hebrews, that whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Think of the examples of people. Eli, Gehazi, Achan. Think of the difference between people who could handle reproof and who could not. It's just as important that we deal with attitudes as it is that we deal with actions when we're involved in educating young Christians. Help children see the value of the policeman on the street, the teacher in the classroom, the value of respecting an employer. Tell the child about a time when you failed to listen to reproof and paid for it. Proverbs 19, verse 20. Hear counsel and receive instruction, that your way may be wise in the latter end. A third thing, dealing with temptation. This is hit very hard in the book of Proverbs, especially sexual immorality and strong drink. Those two areas. In Proverbs 5, verse 1, my son, attend to my wisdom, bow thine ear to my understanding, that thou mayest regard discretion, and that thy lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as an honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil. Do you remind yourself of that? Have you taught your children that? That there are those in the street and in the classroom who will want them and their bodies and will be extremely attractive on the surface. That their lips will drop words like honeycombs and their approach will be as smooth as oil because it's practiced. Have you taught them that her end, verse 4, is as bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death and her steps take hold on hell. That as hard to believe as it is at the time, the end really is not worth the momentary pleasure. That's something we have to have well in mind and well decided before the temptation comes, so that we can flee. In the sixth chapter, this is continued on, and I'm not going to emphasize it here. But he said that these instructions are to keep you from that temptation. So we need to learn and teach our child how to spend our mental energy in the right ways. Have you learned to deal with this personally? If you have, it's very possible that your child has not. Maybe they don't know how to deal with these kinds of people at all. And unfortunately, sometimes the people who are described here are even in the church or seem to be a part of the church. This can make it all the more deceptive and difficult to deal with. He doesn't meet her later on when he becomes a businessman traveling away from home. He meets her right now. Teach him how to say no when there is every occasion to say yes. And strong drink is also emphasized. Sometimes we forget, I think, that if the children just went by what they see and hear around them on the billboards and other advertisements, they would be led completely down the wrong path of life. And they do need some words from us on these subjects occasionally. The 23rd chapter of Proverbs deals with heavy drinkers of wine. It talks there about how attractive it looks, and yet you'll be in rags if you get involved with it. I'll just read a little bit of this, beginning in verse 29. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? They that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his color in the cup, when it moveth itself aright. Don't even look at it. Verse 32. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women, thine heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast. They have stricken me, shalt thou say, and I was not sick. They have beaten me, and I felt it not, because I was so anesthetized because of the drug. When shall I awake? And then, the most tragic line in the whole chapter, I will seek it yet again. Because now I'm addicted to it. I've convinced myself that I can't live without it. I will seek it yet again. So I'm caught in this miserable whirlpool. Alcohol is set before us, pressed upon us. Not as much as it one time was, perhaps, but still in young people's circles, it is, and it's looked on as a sign of adulthood to use it in many cases. And it can tear down character quicker than we can possibly build it up. It'll sting like a snake. This is another area of general training and education, dealing with temptation. Also, a fourth one is the handling of finances. Proverbs 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with thy substance. Teach the young person to invest their money in things that are honoring to God. Teach them the principles of giving and earning. Principles of spending and saving. In the 22nd chapter of Proverbs, verse 7, the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Verse 9, he that hath a bountiful eye shall be blessed, for he giveth of his bread to the poor. These are establishing principles. When you give your child money, an allowance or however that's handled, is there instruction along with that as to how it would be best to spend it? Does your child know the value of giving? Do they know the wisdom of saving? Are they learning about this? Now, here's an area where the bents really show up. You may have one child by nature who is a saver automatically. Another child immediately spends everything. It wouldn't matter if he had $1 million. He wouldn't have it long. And they seem to be this way from birth. I don't know how else to account for the fact that two children in the same family, eating off the same table, hearing the same instruction, can be so different, but they are. Those who are parents know that this is true. So we have more teaching to do in this area for one child than we might for another. Have we shown them how to buy, not necessarily the cheapest thing, but quality, which may take longer to save for? Have we taken them to the store and shown them why we buy the things we do and why we don't buy other things? And does my own example support the message that I'm trying to put across? Solomon says here that the one who borrows constantly becomes a slave to the money lender. Your family will be rare if everybody in it learns to manage their money well. That almost never happens in a family. And fifth, as a general area of training for young people who are or will be Christians, the principle of working hard. Also in the book of Proverbs, this time chapter 10, verses 4 and 5. He becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. He that gathereth in summer is a wise son, but he that sleepeth in harvest is a son that causeth shame. We need to find some way to teach our children that hard work pays off, because the message of the world around them is just the opposite. Only the stupid people work. The smart people get by without it. That's the message of, I'm afraid, almost the majority of the friends that our young people may have at school. If they listen to their friends, they're going to get a completely non-biblical message. God says that all of us should learn the value of hard work. I'll use one more passage on this in chapter 13, verse 4. The soul of the sluggard desireth and hath nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made fat, fat being the word for increase. If we give and give and give to our children without them needing to work, how will they learn to work hard? So these are five general areas that I think we start with as we're determining the way that is built into that child's own specific strong and weak set of points. We're also teaching them generally to be able to stand alone, to be open to reproof, to accept correction, to deal with temptation, to handle their finances, and to work hard. I'm going to pause at this point and see if you have any questions or thoughts before we go on. Jim?
You haven't mentioned this specifically, and I understand why, but I wonder if you would comment on this. There are people who say that if a child is properly trained, that he will become a Christian. And sometimes parents work very hard with children. They believe they're properly trained. At least they've done their best. As soon as those children leave their homes, they leave the church. Is that a failure on the part of the parent, or is that a failure on the part of the young person, or is it both?
Well, it's primarily a failure on the part of the young person. We can't take our individual personal responsibility and place it on anybody else. However, if that was my child, I would feel that I very likely had failed in some point, and I would attempt to determine what it was. You understand that I'm still young enough and my children are young enough that I can still qualify as an expert in this category. I won't be teaching on this subject too many more years. Vern, go ahead.
Norlie and I have received more compliments from our children over the fact that we taught them how to work and responsibility than any other phase of life.
Thank you very much. That is a valuable asset. Michael.
You were talking about making friends and carefully choosing friends. Comment on the statement that I want to be friends with everybody. Everybody that I meet is my friend.
Well, there are gradations, infinite gradations of friendship and acquaintanceship. But I was talking about our closest friends, the ones that we consort with to develop our confidences. The ones that we're closest to, I believe, should be the ones who have the same standard that we have. If Christian young people go out, even if they get into trouble, they're all departing from the same standard and they all know it. If our children go out with the children of the world and get into trouble, the children of the world don't even know there is a standard to depart from. And that's a different attitude and one that can rub off on our own children. So I'd rather have them be with the children of the other Christians and with other Christian children and develop the closest friendships there. This doesn't mean that we're unfriendly to everyone we meet, but I'm talking about closer relationships when I'm referring to friendship. Marvin?
I think, too, we have to teach our children that it's all right to stand alone. Mm-hmm. Even among our best friends, it's all right to stand alone. Like Paul said, when all others forsook me, the Lord stood with me.
Absolutely. And there are times, even in the church, where we have to stand alone. And it's really not so bad once we get used to the idea. We just need to start learning it early. Lowell.
I wouldn't surprise to see legislation proposed to ban spanking. Would you comment a little bit more about the rod? I'm probably as opposed to using something other than my hand as some people are against spanking. Would you comment more on what all the rod might involve?
Okay. I'm not sure that the implement we use for this makes all that much difference. The important thing is that it hurt. if it doesn't hurt, it's not worth, it's worse than not doing it at all. The whole purpose of it is to hurt. And I've heard a lot of psychological talk about how we ought not to use the hand, but we ought to use something that's not a part of the parent so that the child doesn't resent the parent. That's meaningless to me. I don't understand that. It's still the parent hurting the child. The attitude of the parent must be right. It really does hurt you more than it does them. And if it doesn't hurt you more than it does them, then I worry about both you and them. But it has to hurt, and it's administered for a specific reason. That is to establish the relationship and the authority of that relationship. When the child has defied the parent, then that parent has no choice but what to administer punishment that will establish the relationship. And the parent has to win. It doesn't matter whether the child is 2 years old or 18 years old if he's still living under the parent's roof. The parent has to do whatever's necessary to win that fight. If he loses that fight, he'll just have a worse fight the next day. Either that or he'll abdicate the whole responsibility. But if I'm trying to teach a 16-month-old child, if the child knows where the candy is and so he's going to the drawer and he opens it and I say, no, shut that drawer, then I have to be willing before I ever make that statement to be sure I'm willing to take the time and attention at the moment to back that up and be sure that he shuts that drawer. And if it takes whatever time it takes, I need to be sure that he does that. The quicker they learn, I think by administering discipline early and establishing this relationship, we actually save ourselves the necessity with most children of having to do it so much later on. One reason I'm convinced that some parents have such a difficult time with their children constantly is that they didn't take the time and attention early to establish that relationship. If the child doesn't know that no means no, then they're always going to be testing it. If they know it, and they know what happens if they don't obey it, then if they're logical at all, they're not going to want to take the flak for disobedience. They obey, first of all, because they fear us. Later they learn to obey, we hope, because they love us. But the fear of the parent is the beginning of knowledge, just as it is with the Lord.
I used to think, I used to think of it this way. We don't like to cause our children pain. We have to have some backbone of our own to do this. Mm-hmm. But I used to think of it this way. I may hurt him a little bit now, but I'm saving him a world of hurt later.
Absolutely. And it really is done out of love, although it's difficult for a portion of our audience to believe that. It really is. I love you too much to let you get by with what you just did.
I think in administering discipline this way, just like Jim was talking about, stopping false doctrine, false teaching, and it needs to be stopped now. The administration of discipline needs to be done now.
Yes.
Instead of later on when the child's forgotten about it and other things have happened too. The immediate action is
absolutely
is important.
And I also appreciated the point that attitude is such an important thing in this, in the earlier class where Jim was remarking about it in the church, and that's just as true with the child. Our reaction should be far different if our child has had an accident inadvertently and maybe performed the same action as if he had purposefully done something. If he accidentally knocks over his glass of milk, our reaction should be far different than if he purposefully does it or just defiantly takes it and throws it on someone. Far different. We have to hold something in reserve for defiance, for the worst things, and that's what the rod is about, I think. Joanne?
I would just like to say, when he commented on when you teach your children to be Christians and then when they become adults, how they go a separate way. Mm-hmm. Looking at my mother's instance, and she raised us all in the church from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And well, my father wasn't in the church, and we all decided to go his way, you mm-hmm. know. But I think she firmly believed that she instilled in us from the very beginning what she mm-hmm. should have, you yes. know, which was to learn the importance of God and the Bible and the church. And she just had faith that once we decided to grow up, we were going to come back.
Mm-hmm. And she may have done the very best that she could have under the circumstances, and it's possible that her training may still well come through in others of your siblings. I was talking with a man just the other day, and he said there were three of us in the family. We were all taught the same thing. I believed it. The other two didn't. He didn't know how to explain that, and I sure don't know how to fully explain it either.
We're taught to be honest and toward all men, and I believe that that means your children, too. That if I say you're going to get a spanking, I better follow
through
with the spanking, or else I'm a liar to him, and he knows it.
Exactly the reason that your mother didn't want you to tell them that you were going to knock their block off, because then you'd be forced to do it. Hello.
I guess the argument I'm hearing from people that are anti-spanking more than anything is that physical spanking provokes them to want to strike out against others, and that what's our best argument against that?
Well, I don't think that that's true. I think if we do it right, what we're seeking here is to curb or break a will that's defiant against the parent. And we spank enough and make it hurt enough that that will is curbed. And after we're finished with it, we stay with the child. In the first place, the child needs to know why the spanking is being administered. Spanking a child who doesn't know why is like baptizing a man who doesn't know why. In neither case does it do any good. Because what's going on in the brain, in the mind here, is what we're after. So the child needs to clearly understand why the spanking is being administered. Then they need to experience the spanking. It needs to hurt. I believe it should hurt, and of course there are all gradations here, but when we're talking about a full-fledged spanking, it should hurt enough for the child to genuinely cry, not fake cry so they can get it over with, but genuinely cry. And if we know the child, we know the difference. And then we stay with the child. Quite often, isn't it true that our children even want to hug after this has been administered? They really do know that we love them. If we have the right relationship. Spanking is only done within the context of the total parent-child relationship. It's only one little aspect. Hopefully, it doesn't even happen very often. With some children, it will almost never happen. With some children, it will happen fairly frequently. The child decides that. But I don't see anything here that would indicate that this would instruct the child to administer this to other people except their own children. And I want them to do it with their own children. By the way, we don't hit in the face. There is a particular portion of the anatomy sufficiently padded for the purpose. Steve.
I just want to say that I'm not an expert, but it's been my experience with my children. And by the time they were 2 or 2.5 years old, the need for spanking ceased. Mm-hmm. Just my merely looking at them took care of it. And if they did think about trying something, they would always check to see if I still was standing firm.
Very good.
I always kept my promise.
Very good. When we always keep our promise, they'll always believe that we're going to keep our promise. If we keep it sometimes, if we're inconsistent. And I think this is probably the one hardest thing about it, is being consistent even when you don't have time. Think about it before you make the statement. If you're going to make the statement, be sure you're going to stand behind it. Tom, go ahead.
I think it's Dave's turn.
Dave, okay, you go ahead, Dave.
That made any difference. I think what you said about the bend of the child is extremely important, that they are different, and that we have to treat them differently, including discipline, that it's different from one child to the next as far as how they're going to react to it and what's going to be necessary. And I think probably we as parents make more mistakes than the kids do as far as that's concerned. Mm-hmm. The issue I wanted to bring up on top of that, though, is going back to something that you touched on very lightly, but I think is extremely important, and that is the woman being present while the child's being reared. And I can't do anything but quote statistics when you look at what has happened to our country since the women have reentered the workforce since World War II, and the rate of divorce is up, the rate of children with problems is up. Everything is just astronomical since that has happened. And I don't think we preach nearly enough to our children the importance of the presence of a mother or maybe it's a grandmother, somebody who can care for that child while that child is in its most formative years. And all you got to do is look around you to see the problems that are happening because of that. So I'd like a recommendation of how do we train our children to value that.
Well, that is so important. I have a friend who teaches in an inner city school where everything goes on. There's all kinds of problems of every variety. But he said that he's never seen a serious problem with a child who had a mother at home. All of these things were caused by people who didn't have their mothers at home. I guess we train them primarily by example. If we for instance, when, and I don't like to use personal examples, but I'll make an exception here. When our daughter was in kindergarten or first grade, they had a unit in school as to what career you wanted to go into. And people chose various things. Well, the one that our little girl chose was to be a mother and homemaker. Not because we said, I don't know if we ever said that or not in words, but that was what she saw her mother doing, and that was the way she wanted to pattern herself. So the picture she drew was of a woman holding a little baby and caring for it, just as she saw her mother caring for her little brother. So now I've embarrassed her enough for the whole week. Appreciate it, Dave. Tom, then we'll have to stop.